This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Rebecca. Written by Daphne du Maurier. Read by Anna Macy.
Chapter 1. Last night, I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me. There was a padlock and a chain upon the gate. I called in my dream to the lodgekeeper, and had no answer, and peering closer through the rusted spokes of the gate, I saw that the lodge was uninhabited. No smoke came from the chimney, and the little lattice windows gaped, forlorn. Then, like all dreamers, I was possessed of a sudden with supernatural powers, and passed like a spirit through the barrier before me. The drive wound away in front of me, twisting and turning as it had always done, but as I advanced, I was aware that a change had come upon it. It was narrow and unkept, not the drive that we had known. At first I was puzzled and did not understand, and it was only when I bent my head to avoid the low swinging branch of a tree that I realized what had happened. Nature had come into her own again, and little by little, in her stealthy, insidious way, had encroached upon the drive with long, tenacious fingers. The woods, always a menace even in the past, had triumphed in the end. They crowded, dark and uncontrolled, to the borders of the drive. The beeches, with white, naked limbs, leant close to one another, their branches intermingled in a strange embrace, making a vault above my head like the archway of a church. And there were other trees as well, trees that I did not recognize, squat oaks and tortured elms that straggled cheek by jowl with the beeches and had thrust themselves out of the quiet earth, along with monster shrubs and plants, none of which I remembered. The drive was a ribbon now, a thread of its former self, with gravel surface gone and choked with grass and moss. The trees had thrown out low branches, making an impediment to progress. The gnarled roots looked like skeleton claws. Scattered here and again amongst this jungle growth, I would recognize shrubs that had been landmarks in our time, things of culture and grace, hydrangeas whose blue heads had been famous. No hand had checked their progress, and they had gone native now, rearing to monster height without a bloom, black and ugly as the nameless parasites that grew beside them. On and on, now east, now west, wound the poor thread that once had been our drive. Sometimes I thought it lost, but it appeared again, beneath a fallen tree perhaps, or struggling on the other side of a muddied ditch created by the winter rains. I had not thought the way so long. Surely the miles had multiplied, even as the trees had done, and this path led but to a labyrinth, some choked wilderness, and not to the house at all. I came upon it suddenly, the approach masked by the unnatural growth of a vast shrub that spread in all directions, and I stood, my heart thumping in my breast, the strange prick of tears behind my eyes. There was Manderley. Our Manderley, secretive and silent as it had always been, the grey stone shining in the moonlight of my dream, the mullioned windows reflecting the green lawns and the terrace. Time could not wreck the perfect symmetry of those walls, nor the site itself, a jewel in the hollow of a hand. The terrace sloped to the lawns, and the lawns stretched to the sea, and turning I could see the sheet of silver, placid under the moon, like a lake undisturbed by wind or storm. No waves would come to ruffle this dream water, and no bulk of cloud, wind-driven from the west, obscure the clarity of this pale sky. I turned again to the house, and though it stood inviolate, untouched, as though we ourselves had left but yesterday, I saw that the garden had obeyed the jungle law, even as the woods had done. The rhododendrons stood 50 feet high, twisted and entwined with bracken, and they had entered into alien marriage with a host of nameless shrubs, poor bastard things that clung about their roots as though conscious of their spurious origin. A lilac had mated with a copper beech, and to bind them yet more closely to one another, the malevolent ivy, always an enemy to grace, had thrown her tendrils about the pair and made them prisoners. Ivy held prior place in this lost garden. The long strands crept across the lawns and soon would encroach upon the house itself. There was another plant, too, some half-breed from the woods, whose seed had been scattered long ago beneath the trees and then forgotten, and now, marching in unison with the ivy, thrust its ugly form like a giant rhubarb towards the soft grass where the daffodils had blown. Nettles were everywhere, the vanguard of the army. They choked the terrace, they sprawled about the paths, they leant, vulgar and lanky, against the very windows of the house. They made indifferent sentinels, for in many places their ranks had been broken by the rhubarb plant, and they lay with crumpled heads and listless stems, making a pathway for the rabbits. I left the drive and went on to the terrace, for the nettles were no barrier to me, a dreamer. I walked, enchanted, and nothing held me back. Moonlight can play odd tricks upon the fancy, even upon a dreamer's fancy. As I stood there, hushed and still, I could swear that the house was not an empty shell, but lived and breathed as it had lived before. Light came from the windows, the curtains blew softly in the night air, and there, in the library, the door would stand half open as we had left it, with my handkerchief on the table beside the bowl of autumn roses. The room would bear witness to our presence, the little heap of library books marked ready to return, and the discarded copy of The Times. Ashtrays with the stub of a cigarette, cushions with the imprint of our heads upon them, lolling in the chairs, the charred embers of our log fire still smouldering against the morning. And Jasper, dear Jasper, with his soulful eyes and great sagging drowl, would be stretched upon the floor, his tail a thump, when he heard his master's footsteps. A cloud, hitherto unseen, came upon the moon, and hovered an instant like a dark hand before a face. The illusion went with it, and the lights in the windows were extinguished. I looked upon the desolate shell, soulless at last, unhaunted, with no whisper of the past about its staring walls. The house was a sepulchre. Our fear and suffering lay buried in the ruins. There would be no resurrection. When I thought of Manderley in my waking hours, I would not be bitter. I should think of it as it might have been, could I have lived there without fear. I should remember the rose garden in summer, and the birds that sang at dawn, tea under the chestnut tree, and the murmur of the sea coming up to us from the lawns below. I would think of the blown lilac and the happy valley. These things were permanent. They could not be dissolved. They were memories that cannot hurt. All this I resolved in my dream, while the clouds lay across the face of the moon, for like most sleepers, I knew that I dreamed. In reality, I lay many hundred miles away in an alien land, and would wake, before many seconds had passed, in the bare little hotel bedroom, comforting in its very lack of atmosphere. I would sigh a moment, stretch myself and turn, and opening my eyes, be bewildered at that glittering sun, that hard, clean sky, so different from the soft moonlight of my dream. The day would lie before us both, long, no doubt, and uneventful, but fraught with a certain stillness, a dear tranquillity we had not known before. We would not talk of Manderley. I would not tell my dream. For Mandalay was ours no longer. Mandalay was no more. Chapter 2. We can never go back again. That much is certain. The past is still too close to us. The things we have tried to forget and put behind us would stir again, and that sense of fear, of furtive unrest, struggling at length to blind, unreasoning panic, now mercifully stilled, thank God, might in some manner, unforeseen, become a living companion, as it had been before. He is wonderfully patient, and never complains, not even when he remembers, which happens, I think, rather more often than he would have me know. I can tell by the way he will look lost and puzzled suddenly, all expression dying away from his dear face, as though swept clean by an unseen hand, and in its place a mask will form, a sculptured thing, formal and cold, beautiful still, but lifeless. He will fall to smoking cigarette after cigarette, not bothering to extinguish them, and the glowing stubs will lie around on the ground like petals. He will talk quickly and eagerly about nothing at all, snatching at any subject as a panacea to pain. I believe there is a theory that men and women emerge finer and stronger after suffering, and that to advance in this or any world, we must endure ordeal by fire. This we have done in full measure, ironic though it seems. We have both known fear, and loneliness, and very great distress. I suppose sooner or later in the life of everyone comes a moment of trial. We all of us have our particular devil who rides us and torments us, and we must give battle in the end. We have conquered ours, or so we believe. The devil does not ride us any more. We have come through our crisis, not unscathed, of course. His premonition of disaster was correct from the beginning, and like a ranting actress in an indifferent play, I might say that we have paid for freedom. But I have had enough melodrama in this life, and would willingly give my 5 senses if they could ensure us our present peace and security. Happiness is not a possession to be prized. It is a quality of thought, a state of mind. Of course we have our moments of depression, but there are other moments, too, when time, unmeasured by the clock, runs on into eternity, and catching his smile, I know we are together. We march in unison. No clash of thought or of opinion makes a barrier between us. We have no secrets now from one another. All things are shared. Granted that our little hotel is dull and the food indifferent, and that day after day dawns very much the same, yet we would not have it otherwise. We should meet too many of the people he knows in any of the big hotels. We both appreciate simplicity, and we are sometimes bored. Well, boredom is a pleasing antidote to fear. We live very much by routine, and I have developed a genius for reading aloud. The only time I have known him show impatience is when the postman lags, for it means we must wait another day before the arrival of our English mail. We have tried wireless, but the noise is such an irritant, and we prefer to store up our excitement. The result of a cricket match played many days ago means much to us. Oh, the test matches that have saved us from ennui, the boxing bouts, even the billiard scores, finals of schoolboy sports, dog racing, strange little competitions in the remoter counties, all these are grist to our hungry mill. Sometimes old copies of The Field come my way, and I am transported from this indifferent island to the realities of an English spring. I read of chalk streams, of the mayfly, of sorrel growing in green meadows, of rooks circling above the woods, as they used to do at Mandalay. The smell of wet earth comes to me from those thumbed and tattered pages, the sour tang of moorland peat, the feel of soggy moss, spattered white in places by a heron's droppings. Once there was an article on wood pigeons, and as I read it aloud, it seemed to me that once again I was in the deep woods at Manderley, with pigeons fluttering above my head. I heard their soft, complacent call, so comfortable and cool on a hot summer's afternoon, and there would be no disturbing of their peace until Jasper came loping through the undergrowth to find me, his damp muzzle questing the ground. Like old ladies caught at their ablutions, the pigeons would flutter from their hiding place, shocked into silly agitation, and making a monstrous to-do with their wings, streak away from us above the treetops, and so out of sight and sound. When they were gone, a new silence would come upon the place, and I, uneasy for no known reason, would realize that the sun no longer wove a pattern on the rustling leaves, that the branches had grown darker, the shadows longer. And back at the house, there would be fresh raspberries for tea. I would rise from my bed of bracken, then, shaking the feathery dust of last year's leaves from my skirt and whistling to Jasper, set off towards the house, despising myself even as I walked for my hurrying feet, my one swift glance behind. How strange that an article on wood pigeons could so recall the past and make me falter as I read aloud. It was the grey look on his face that made me stop abruptly, and turned the pages until I found a paragraph on cricket, very practical and dull. Middlesex batting on a dry wicket at the Oval and piling up interminable dreary runs. How I blessed those solid flanneled figures, for in a few minutes his face had settled back into repose. The colour had returned, and he was deriding the Surrey bowling in healthy irritation. We were saved a retreat into the past, and I had learnt my lesson. Read English news, yes, and English sport, politics and pomposity, but in future, keep the things that hurt to myself alone. They can be my secret indulgence. Colour and scent and sound. Rain and the lapping of water, even the mists of autumn and the smell of the flood tide. These are memories of Manderley that will not be denied. Some people have a vice of reading Bradshaw's. They plan innumerable journeys across country for the fun of linking up impossible connections. My hobby is less tedious, if as strange. I am a mine of information on the English countryside. I know the name of every owner of every British moor. Yes, and their tenants, too. I know how many grouse are killed, how many partridge, how many head of deer. I know where trout are rising, and where the salmon leap. I attend all meets, I follow every run. Even the names of those who walk hound puppies are familiar to me. The state of the crops, the price of fat cattle, the mysterious ailments of swine. I relish them all. A poor pastime, perhaps, and not a very intellectual one, but I breathe the air of England as I read, and can face this glittering sky with greater courage. The scrubby vineyards and the crumbling stones become things of no account, for if I wish, I can give rein to my imagination, and pick foxgloves and pale campions from a wet, streaking hedge. Poor whims of fancy, tender and unharsh, they are the enemy to bitterness and regret, and sweeten this exile we have brought upon ourselves. Because of them, I can enjoy my afternoon, and return smiling and refreshed to face the little ritual of our tea. The order never varies. Two slices of bread and butter each, and China tea. What a hide-bound couple we must seem, clinging to custom because we did so in England. Here, on this clean balcony, white and impersonal with centuries of sun, I think of 4:30 at Manderley, and the table drawn before the library fire. The door flung open, punctual to the minute, and the performance never varying of the laying of the tea, the silver tray, the kettle, the snowy cloth. While Jasper, his spaniel ears adroop, feigns indifference to the arrival of the cakes. That feast was laid before us always, and yet we ate so little. Those dripping crumpets, I can see them now, Tiny crisp wedges of toast and piping hot floury scones. Sandwiches of unknown nature, mysteriously flavoured and quite delectable. And that very special gingerbread. Angel cake that melted in the mouth and his rather stodgier companion, bursting with peel and raisins. There was enough food there to keep a starving family for a week. I never knew what happened to it all, and the waste used to worry me sometimes. But I never dared ask Mrs. Danvers what she did about it. She would have looked at me in scorn, smiling that freezing, superior smile of hers, and I can imagine her saying, "There were never any complaints when Mrs. de Winter was alive." Mrs. Danvers. I wonder what she is doing now. She and Favelle. I think it was the expression on her face that gave me my first feeling of unrest. Instinctively, I thought, she is comparing me to Rebecca. And sharp as a sword, the shadow came between us. Well, it is over now, finished and done with. I ride no more tormented, and both of us are free. Even my faithful Jasper has gone to the happy hunting grounds, and Manderley is no more. It lies like an empty shell amidst the tangle of the deep woods, even as I saw it in my dream. A multitude of weeds, a colony of birds. Sometimes, perhaps, a tramp will wander there, seeking shelter from a sudden shower of rain. And if he is stout-hearted, he may walk there with impunity. But your timid fellow, your nervous poacher, the woods of Manderley are not for him. He might stumble upon the little cottage in the cove, and he would not be happy beneath its tumbled roof, the thin rain beating at two. There might linger there still a certain atmosphere of stress. That corner in the drive, too, where the trees encroach upon the gravel, is not a place in which to pause, not after the sun has set. When the leaves rustle, they sound very much like the stealthy movement of a woman in evening dress, and when they shiver suddenly and fall and scatter away along the ground, they might be the patter, patter of a woman's hurrying footstep, and the mark in the gravel, the imprint of a high-heeled satin shoe. It is when I remember these things that I return with relief to the prospect from our balcony. No shadows steal upon this hard glare. The stony vineyards shimmer in the sun, and the bougainvillea is white with dust. I may one day look upon it with affection. At the moment it inspires me, if not with love, at least with confidence. And confidence is a quality I prize, although it has come to me a little late in the day. I suppose it is his dependence upon me that has made me bold at last. At any rate, I have lost my diffidence, my timidity, my shyness with strangers. I am very different from that self who drove to Manderley for the first time, hopeful and eager, handicapped by a rather desperate gaucherie, and filled with an intense desire to please. It was my lack of poise, of course, that made such a bad impression on people like Mrs. Danvers. What must I have seemed like after Rebecca? I can see myself now, memory spanning the years like a bridge, with straight bobbed hair and youthful unpowdered face, dressed in an ill-fitting coat and skirt and a jumper of my own creation, trailing in the wake of Mrs. Van Hopper, like a shy, uneasy colt. She would precede me into lunch, her short body ill-balanced upon tottering high heels, her fussy, frilly blouse a compliment to her large bosom and swinging hips, her new hat pierced with a monster quill aslant upon her head, exposing a wide expanse of forehead, bare as a schoolboy's knee. One hand carried a gigantic bag, the kind that holds passports, engagement diaries, and bridge scores, while the other hand toyed with that inevitable lorgnette, the enemy to other people's privacy. She would make for her usual table in the corner of the restaurant, close to the window, and, lifting her lorgnette to her small pig's eyes, survey the scene to right and left of her. Then she would let the lorgnette fall at length upon its black ribbon and utter a little exclamation of disgust. "Not a single well-known personality. I shall tell the management they must make a reduction on my bill. What do they think I come here for, to look at the page boys?" and she would summon the waiter to her side, her voice sharp and staccato, cutting the air like a saw. How different the little restaurant where we are today, to that vast dining room, ornate and ostentatious, the Hotel Côte d'Azur at Monte Carlo. And how different my present companion. His steady, well-shaped hands peeling a mandarin in quiet, methodical fashion, looking up now and again from his task to smile at me. Compared to Mrs. Van Hopper, her fat, bejeweled fingers questing a plate heaped high with ravioli, her eyes darting suspiciously from her plate to mine, for fear I should have made the better choice. She need not have disturbed herself, for the waiter, with the uncanny swiftness of his kind, had long sensed my position as inferior and subservient to hers, and had placed before me a plate of ham and tongue that somebody had sent back to the cold buffet half an hour before as badly carved. Odd, that resentment of servants and their obvious impatience. I remember staying once with Mrs. Van Hopper in a country house, and the maid never answered my timid bell or brought up my shoes, and early morning tea, stone cold, was dumped outside my bedroom door. It was the same at the Côte d'Azur, though to a lesser degree, and sometimes the studied indifference turned to familiarity, smirking and offensive, which made buying stamps from the reception clerk an ordeal I would avoid. How young and inexperienced I must have seemed! And how I felt it, too. One was too sensitive, too raw. There were thorns and pinpricks in so many words that in reality fell lightly on the air. I remember well that plate of ham and tongue. It was dry, unappetizing, cut in a wedge from the outside, but I had not the courage to refuse it. We ate in silence, for Mrs. Van Hopper liked to concentrate on food, and I could tell by the way the sauce ran down her chin that her dish of ravioli pleased her. It was not a sight that engendered into me great appetite for my own cold choice, and looking away from her, I saw that the table next to ours, left vacant for 3 days, was to be occupied once more. The maître d'hôtel, with the particular bow reserved for his more special patrons, was ushering the new arrival to his place. Mrs. Van Hopper put down her fork and reached for her lorgnette. I blushed for her while she stared, and the newcomer, unconscious of her interest, cast a wandering eye over the menu. Then Mrs. Van Hopper folded her lorgnette with a snap and leant across the table to me, her small eyes bright with excitement, her voice a shade too loud. "It's Max de Winter," she said. "The man who owns Manderley. You've heard of it, of course. He looks ill, doesn't he? They say he can't get over his wife's death." Chapter 3. I wonder what my life would be today if Mrs. Van Hopper had not been a snob. Funny to think that the course of my existence hung like a thread upon that quality of hers. Her curiosity was a disease, almost a mania. At first I had been shocked, wretchedly embarrassed. I would feel like a whipping boy who must bear his master's pains when I watched people laugh behind her back, leave a room hurriedly upon her entrance, or even vanish behind a service door on the corridor upstairs. For many years now she had come to the Hotel Côte d'Azur, and, apart from bridge, her one pastime, which was notorious by now in Monte Carlo, was to claim visitors of distinction as her friends. Had she but seen them once at the other end of the post office. Somehow she would manage to introduce herself, and before her victim had scented danger, she had proffered an invitation to her suite. Her method of attack was so downright and sudden that there was seldom opportunity to escape. At the Côte d'Azur she staked a claim upon a certain sofa in the lounge, midway between the reception hall and the passage to the restaurant, and she would have her coffee there after luncheon and dinner, and all who came and went must pass her by. Sometimes she would employ me as a bait to draw her prey, and, hating my errand, I would be sent across the lounge with a verbal message. The loan of a book or paper, the address of some shop or other, the sudden discovery of a mutual friend. It seemed as though notables must be fed to her, much as invalids are spooned their jelly, and though titles were preferred by her, Any face once seen in a social paper served as well. Names scattered in a gossip column, authors, artists, actors and their kind, even the mediocre ones, as long as she had learnt of them in print. I can see her as though it were but yesterday, on that unforgettable afternoon, never mind how many years ago, when she sat at her favourite sofa in the lounge, debating her method of attack. I could tell by her abrupt manner and the way she tapped her lorgnette against her teeth that she was questing possibilities. I knew, too, when she had missed the sweet and rushed through dessert, that she had wished to finish luncheon before the new arrival, and so install herself where he must pass. Suddenly she turned to me, her small eyes alight. "Go upstairs quickly and find that letter from my nephew. You remember? The one written on his honeymoon with the snapshot. Bring it down to me right away." I saw then that her plans were formed, and the nephew was to be the means of introduction. Not for the first time I resented the part that I must play in her schemes. Like a juggler's assistant, I produced the props. Then, silent and attentive, I waited on my cue. This newcomer would not welcome intrusion. I felt certain of that. In the little I had learnt of him at luncheon, a smattering of hearsay garnered by her 10 months ago from the daily papers and stored in her memory for future use, I could imagine, in spite of my youth and inexperience of the world, that he would resent this sudden bursting in upon his solitude. Why he should have chosen to come to the Côte d'Azur at Monte Carlo was not our concern. His problems were his own, and anyone but Mrs. Van Hopper would have understood. Tact was a quality unknown to her, discretion too, and because gossip was the breath of life to her, this stranger must be served for her dissection. I found the letter in a pigeonhole in her desk, and hesitated a moment before going down again to the lounge. It seemed to me, rather senselessly, that I was allowing him a few more moments of seclusion. I wished I had the courage to go by the service staircase and so by roundabout way to the restaurant, and there warn him of the ambush. Convention was too strong for me, though, nor did I know how I should frame my sentence. There was nothing for it but to sit in my usual place beside Mrs. Van Hopper, while she, like a large, complacent spider, spun her wide net of tedium about the stranger's person. I had been longer than I thought, for when I returned to the lounge, I saw he had already left the dining room, and she, fearful of losing him, had not waited for the letter, but had risked a barefaced introduction on her own. He was even now sitting beside her on the sofa. I walked across to them and gave her the letter without a word. He rose to his feet at once, while Mrs. Van Hopper, flushed with her success, waved a vague hand in my direction and mumbled my name. "Mr. de Winter is having coffee with us. Go and ask the waiter for another cup," she said, her tone just casual enough to warn him of my footing. It meant I was a youthful thing and unimportant, and that there was no need to include me in the conversation. She always spoke in that tone when she wished to be impressive, and her method of introduction was a form of self-protection. For once I had been taken for her daughter, an acute embarrassment for us both. This abruptness showed that I could safely be ignored, and women would give me a brief nod which served as a greeting and a dismissal in one, while men, with large relief, would realize they could sink back into a comfortable chair without offending courtesy. It was a surprise, therefore, to find that this newcomer remained standing on his feet, and it was he who made a signal to the waiter. "I'm afraid I must contradict you," he said to her. "You are both having coffee with me." And before I knew what had happened, he was sitting in my usual hard chair, and I was on the sofa beside Mrs. Van Hopper. For a moment she looked annoyed. This was not what she had intended. But she soon composed her face, and thrusting her large self between me and the table, she leant forward to his chair, talking eagerly and loudly, fluttering the letter in her hand. "You know I recognized you just as soon as you walked into the restaurant," she said.
and I thought, why, there's Mr. De Winter, Billy's friend. I simply must show him those snaps of Billy and his bride taken on their honeymoon. And here they are. There's Dora. Isn't she just adorable, that little slim waist, those great big eyes? Here they are, sunbathing at Palm Beach. Billy is crazy about her, you can imagine. He had not met her, of course, when he gave that party at Claridge's and where I saw you first, but I dare say you don't remember an old woman like me.
This, with a provocative glance and a gleam of teeth. On the contrary, I remember you very well, he said, and before she could trap him into a resurrection of their first meeting, he had handed her his cigarette case, and the business of lighting up stalled her for the moment. I don't think I should care for Palm Beach, he said, blowing the match. And glancing at him, I thought how unreal he would look against a Florida background. He belonged to a walled city of the 15th century, a city of narrow, cobbled streets and thin spires, where the inhabitants wore pointed shoes and worsted hose. His face was arresting, sensitive, medieval in some strange, inexplicable way, and I was reminded of a portrait seen in a gallery, I'd forgotten where, of a certain gentleman unknown. Could one but rob him of his English tweeds and put him in black, with lace at his throat and wrists, he would stare down at us in our new world from a long-distant past, a past where men walked cloaked at night and stood in the shadow of old doorways, a past of narrow stairways and dim dungeons, a past of whispers in the dark, of shimmering rapier blades, of silent, exquisite courtesy. I wished I could remember the old master who had painted that portrait. It stood in a corner of the gallery, and the eyes followed one from the dusky frame. They were talking, though, and I had lost the thread of conversation.
"No, not even 20 years ago," he was saying. "That sort of thing has never amused me."
I heard Mrs. Van Hopper give her fat, complacent laugh.
"If Billy had a home like Manderley, he would not want to play around in Palm Beach," she said. "I'm told it's like fairyland. There's no other word for it."
She paused, expecting him to smile, but he went on smoking his cigarette, and I noticed, faint as gossamer, the line between his brows.
"I've seen pictures of it, of course," she persisted, "and it looks perfectly enchanting. I remember Billy telling me it had all those big places beat for beauty. I wonder you can ever bear to leave it."
His silence now was painful, and would have been patent to anyone else, but she ran on like a clumsy goat, trampling and trespassing on land that was preserved, and I felt the colour flood my face, dragged with her as I was into humiliation.
"Of course you Englishmen are all the same about your home," she said, her voice becoming louder and louder. "You'd appreciate them so as not to seem proud. Isn't there a minstrel's gallery at Manderley and some very valuable portraits?"
She turned to me by way of explanation.
"Mr. De Winter is so modest he won't admit to it, but I believe the lovely home of his has been in his family's possession since the Conquest. They say that minstrel's gallery is a gem. I suppose your ancestors often entertain royalty at Manderley, Mr. De Winter."
This was more than I had hitherto endured, even from her, but the swift lash of his reply was unexpected.
"Not since Ethelred," he said. "The one who was called Unready. In fact, it was while staying with my family that the name was given him. He was invariably late for dinner."
She deserved it, of course, and I waited for her change of face. But incredible as it may seem, his words were lost on her, and I was left to writhe in her stead, feeling like a child that had been smacked.
"Is that really so?" she blundered. "I'd no idea. My history is very shaky, and the kings of England always muddled me. How interesting, though. I must write and tell my daughter she's a great scholar."
There was a pause, and I felt the colour flood into my face. I was too young. That was the trouble. Had I been older, I would have caught his eye and smiled, her unbelievable behaviour making a bond between us. But as it was, I was stricken into shame and endured one of the frequent agonies of youth. I think he realized my distress, for he leant forward in his chair and spoke to me, his voice gentle, asking if I would have more coffee, and when I refused and shook my head, I felt his eyes were still on me, puzzled, reflective. He was pondering my exact relationship to her, and wondering whether he must bracket us together in futility. "What do you think of Monte Carlo, or don't you think of it at all?" he said. This, including me in the conversation, found me at my worst, the raw ex-schoolgirl, red-elbowed and lanky-haired. And I said something obvious and idiotic about the place being artificial, but before I could finish my halting sentence, Mrs. Van Hopper interrupted.
"She's spoilt, Mr. De Winter, that's her trouble. Most girls would give their eyes for the chance of seeing Monty."
"Wouldn't that rather defeat the purpose?" he said, smiling. She shrugged her shoulders, blowing a great cloud of cigarette smoke into the air. I don't think she understood him for a moment.
"I'm faithful to Monty," she told him. "The English winter gets me down, and my constitution just won't stand it. What brings you here? You're not one of the regulars. Are you going to play shemmy, or have you brought your golf clubs?"
"I have not made up my mind," he said. "I came away in rather a hurry." His own words must have jolted a memory, for his face clouded again and he frowned very slightly. She babbled on, impervious.
"Of course you miss the fogs at Manderley. It's quite another matter. The West Country must be delightful in the spring."
He reached for the ashtray, squashing his cigarette, and I noticed the subtle change in his eyes, the indefinable something that lingered there momentarily, and I felt I had looked upon something personal to himself with which I had no concern.
"Yes," he said shortly. "Manderley was looking its best."
A silence fell upon us during a moment or two, a silence that brought something of discomfort in its train, and stealing a glance at him, I was reminded more than ever of my gentleman unknown, who cloaked and secret walked a corridor by night. Mrs. Van Hopper's voice pierced my dream like an electric bell.
"I suppose you know a crowd of people here, though I must say Monty is very dull this winter. One sees so few well-known faces. The Duke of Middlesex is here in his yacht, but I haven't been aboard yet."
She never had, to my knowledge.
"You know Nell Middlesex, of course," she went on. "What a charmer she is. They always say that second child isn't his, but I don't believe it. People will say anything, won't they, when a woman is attractive, and she is so very lovely. Tell me, is it true that Caxton Hislop marriage is not a success?"
She ran on, through a tangled fringe of gossip, never seeing that these names were alien to him. They meant nothing, and that as she prattled unaware, he grew colder and more silent. Never for a moment did he interrupt or glance at his watch. It was as though he had set himself a standard of behaviour since the original lapse when he had made a fool of her in front of me, and clung to it grimly rather than offend again. It was a page-boy in the end who released him with the news that a dressmaker awaited Mrs. Van Hopper in the suite. He got up at once, pushing back his chair. "Don't let me keep you," he said. "Fashions change so quickly nowadays, they may even have altered by the time you get upstairs." The sting did not touch her. She accepted it as a pleasantry.
"It's so delightful to have run into you like this, Mr. De Winter," she said as we went towards the lift. "Now I've been brave enough to break the ice. I hope I shall see something of you. You must come and have a drink sometime in the suite. I may have one or two people coming in tomorrow evening. Why not join us?"
I turned away, so that I should not watch him search for an excuse.
"I'm so sorry," he said. "Tomorrow I'm probably driving to Sospel. I'm not sure when I shall get back."
Reluctantly she left it, but we still hovered at the entrance to the lift.
"I hope they've given you a good room. The place is half empty, so if you're uncomfortable, mind you make a fuss. Your valet has unpacked for you, I suppose."
This familiarity was excessive, even for her, and I caught a glimpse of his expression.
"I don't possess one," he said quietly. "Perhaps you would like to do it for me."
This time his shaft had found its mark, for she reddened and laughed a little awkwardly.
"Why, I hardly think—"
she began, And then suddenly and unbelievably she turned upon me.
Perhaps you could make yourself useful to Mr. De Winter, if he wants anything done. You're a capable child in many ways.
There was a momentary pause while I stood stricken, waiting for his answer. He looked down at us, mocking, faintly sardonic, a ghost of a smile on his lips.
"A charming suggestion," he said. "But I cling to the family motto. He travels the fastest who travels alone. Perhaps you have not heard of it."
And without waiting for her answer, he turned and left us.
"What a funny thing to do," said Mrs. Van Hopper as we went upstairs in the lift. "Do you suppose that sudden departure was a form of humour? Men do such extraordinary things. I remember a well-known writer once who used to dart down the service staircase whenever he saw me coming. I suppose he had a penchant for me and wasn't sure of himself. However, I was younger then."
The lift stopped with a jerk. We arrived at our floor. The page boy flung open the gates.
"By the way, dear," she said as we walked along the corridor, "don't think I mean to be unkind, but you put yourself just a teeny bit forward this afternoon. Your efforts to monopolize the conversation quite embarrassed me, and I'm sure it did him. Men loathe that sort of thing."
I said nothing. There seemed no possible reply.
"Oh, come, don't sulk," she laughed and shrugged her shoulders. "After all, I'm responsible for your behavior here, and surely you can accept advice from a woman old enough to be your mother. Eh bien, Blaise, je viens."
And humming a tune, she went into the bedroom where the dressmaker was waiting for her. I knelt on the window seat and looked out upon the afternoon. The sun shone very brightly still, and there was a gay high wind. In half an hour, we should be sitting to our bridge, the windows tightly closed, the central heating turned to the full. I thought of the ashtrays I would have to clear, and how the squashed stubs, stained with lipstick, would sprawl in company with discarded chocolate creams. Bridge does not come easily to a mind brought up on snap and happy families. Besides, it bored her friends to play with me. I felt my youthful presence put a curb upon their conversation, much as a parlourmaid does until the arrival of dessert, and they could not fling themselves so easily into the melting pot of scandal and insinuation. Her men friends would assume a sort of forced heartiness and ask me jocular questions about history or painting, guessing I had not long left school, and that this would be my only form of conversation. I sighed and turned away from the window. The sun was so full of promise, and the sea was whipped white with a merry wind. I thought of that corner of Monaco which I had passed a day or two ago, and where a crooked house lent to a cobbled square. High up in the tumbled roof there was a window, narrow as a slit. It might have held a presence medieval. And reaching to the desk for pencil and paper, I sketched in fancy, with an absent mind, a profile, pale and aquiline, a sombre eye, a high-bridged nose, a scornful upper lip. And I added a pointed beard and lace at the throat, as the painter had done long ago in a different time. Someone knocked at the door, and the lift-boy came in with a note in his hand. "Madame is in the bedroom," I told him, but he shook his head and said it was for me. I opened it and found a single sheet of notepaper inside, with a few words written in an unfamiliar hand.
"Forgive me, I was very rude this afternoon."
That was all. No signature and no beginning. But my name was on the envelope and spelt correctly. An unusual thing. "Is there an answer?" asked the boy. I looked up from the scrawled words. "No," I said. "No, there isn't any answer." When he had gone, I put the note away in my pocket and turned once more to my pencil drawing. For no known reason, it did not please me any more. The face was stiff and lifeless, and the lace collar and the beard were like props in a charade. Chapter 4. The morning after the bridge party, Mrs. Van Hopper woke with a sore throat and a temperature of 102. I rang up her doctor, who came round at once and diagnosed the usual influenza. "You are to stay in bed until I allow you to get up," he told her.
I don't like the sound of that heart of yours, and it won't get better unless you keep perfectly quiet and still. I should prefer, he went on, turning to me, that Mrs. Van Hopper had a trained nurse. You can't possibly lift her. It will only be for a fortnight or so. I thought this rather absurd, and protested, but to my surprise she agreed with him. I think she enjoyed the fuss it would create, the sympathy of people, the visits and messages from friends and the arrival of flowers. Monte Carlo had begun to bore her, and this little illness would make a distraction. The nurse would give her injections and a light massage, and she would have a diet. I left her quite happy after the arrival of the nurse, propped up on pillows with a falling temperature, her best bed jacket round her shoulders, and beribboned boudoir cap upon her head. Rather ashamed of my light heart, I telephoned her friends, putting off the small party she had arranged for the evening, and went down to the restaurant for lunch, a good half hour before our usual time. I expected the room to be empty. Nobody lunched generally before 1 o'clock. It was empty, except for the table next to ours. This was a contingency, for which I was unprepared. I thought he had gone to Sospel. No doubt he was lunching early because he hoped to avoid us at 1 o'clock. I was already halfway across the room and could not go back. I had not seen him since we disappeared in the lift the day before, for wisely he had avoided dinner in the restaurant, possibly for the same reason that he lunched early now. It was a situation for which I was ill-trained. I wished I was older, different. I went to our table looking straight before me, and immediately paid the penalty of gaucherie by knocking over the vase of stiff anemones as I unfolded my napkin. The water soaked the cloth and ran down onto my lap. The waiter was at the other end of the room, nor had he seen. In a second, though, my neighbour was by my side, dry napkin in hand.
"You can't sit at a wet tablecloth," he said brusquely. "It will put you off your food. Get out of the way."
He began to mop the cloth, while the waiter, seeing the disturbance, came swiftly to the rescue. "I don't mind," I said. "It doesn't matter a bit. I'm all alone." He said nothing, and then the waiter arrived and whipped away the vase and the sprawling flowers.
"Leave that," he said suddenly, "and lay another place at my table. Mademoiselle will have luncheon with me."
I looked up in confusion. "Oh, no," I said. "I couldn't possibly."
"Why not?" he said.
I tried to think of an excuse. I knew he did not want to lunch with me. It was his form of courtesy. I should ruin his meal. I determined to be bold and speak the truth. "Please," I begged, "don't be polite. It's very kind of you, but I shall be quite all right if the waiter just wipes the cloth."
"But I'm not being polite," he insisted. "I would like you to have luncheon with me. Even if you had not knocked over that vase so clumsily, I should have asked you."
I suppose my face told him my doubt, for he smiled.
"You don't believe me," he said. "Never mind. Come and sit down. We needn't talk to each other unless we feel like it."
We sat down, and he gave me the menu, leaving me to choose, and went on with his hors d'oeuvre as though nothing had happened. His quality of detachment was peculiar to himself, and I knew that we might continue thus without speaking throughout the meal, and it would not matter. There would be no sense of strain. He would not ask me questions on history.
"What's happened to your friend?" he said.
I told him about the influenza.
"I'm so sorry," he said, and then, after pausing a moment, "You got my note, I suppose. I felt very much ashamed of myself. My manners were atrocious. The only excuse I can make is that I've become boorish through living alone. That's why it's so kind of you to lunch with me today."
"You weren't rude," I said. "At least, not the sort of rudeness she would understand. That curiosity of hers. She does not mean to be offensive, but she does it to everyone. That is, everyone of importance."
"I ought to be flattered, then," he said. "Why should she consider me of any importance?"
I hesitated a moment before replying. "I think because of Manderley," I said. He did not answer. And I was aware again of that feeling of discomfort, as though I had trespassed on forbidden ground. I wondered why it was that this home of his, known to so many people by hearsay, even to me, should so inevitably silence him, making, as it were, a barrier between him and others. We ate for a while without talking, and I thought of a picture postcard I had bought once at a village shop, when on holiday as a child in the West Country. It was the painting of a house, crudely done, of course, and highly coloured, but even those faults could not destroy the symmetry of the building,
the wide stone steps before the terrace, the green lawn stretching to the sea. I paid tuppence for the painting, half my weekly pocket money, and then asked the wrinkled shopwoman what it was meant to be. She looked astonished at my ignorance. "That's Manderley," she said, and I remember coming out of the shop feeling rebuffed, yet hardly wiser than before. Perhaps it was the memory of this postcard, lost long ago in some forgotten book, that made me sympathize with his defensive attitude. He resented Mrs. Van Hopper and her like with their intruding questions. Maybe there was something inviolate about Manderley that made it a place apart. It would not bear discussion. I could imagine her tramping through the rooms, perhaps paying sixpence for admission, ripping the quietude with her sharp staccato laugh. Our minds must have run in the same channel, for he began to talk about her. "Your friend," he began. "She is very much older than you. Is she a relation? Have you known her long?" I saw he was still puzzled by us. "She's not really a friend," I told him. "She's an employer. She's training me to be a thing called a companion, and she pays me £90 a year."
"I did not know one could buy companionship," he said. "It sounds a primitive idea, rather like the Eastern slave market."
I looked up the word companion once in the dictionary, I admitted, and it said, "A companion is a friend of the bosom."
"You haven't much in common with her," he said.
He laughed, looking quite different, younger somehow, and less detached.
"What do you do it for?" he asked me.
£90 is a lot of money to me," I said.
"Haven't you any family?"
"No, they're dead."
"You have a very lovely and unusual name."
"My father was a lovely and unusual person."
"Tell me about him," he said.
I looked at him over my glass of citronade. It was not easy to explain my father, and usually I never talked about him. He was my secret property, preserved for me alone, much as Manderley was preserved for my neighbour. I had no wish to introduce him casually over a table in a Monte Carlo restaurant. There was a strange air of unreality about that luncheon, and looking back upon it now, it is invested for me with a curious glamour. There was I, so much of a schoolgirl still, who only the day before had sat with Mrs. Van Hopper, prim, silent, and subdued, and 24 hours afterwards my family history was mine no longer. I shared it with a man I did not know. For some reason I felt impelled to speak, because his eyes followed me in sympathy, like the gentleman unknown. My shyness fell away from me, loosening as it did so my reluctant tongue, and out they all came, the little secrets of childhood, the pleasures and the pains. It seemed to me as though he understood, from my poor description, something of the vibrant personality that had been my father's, and something, too, of the love my mother had for him, making it a vital living force, with a spark of divinity about it, so much that, when he died that desperate winter, struck down by pneumonia, she lingered behind him for 5 short weeks, and stayed no more. I remember pausing, a little breathless, a little dazed. The restaurant was filled now with people who chatted and laughed to an orchestral background and a clatter of plates, and glancing at the clock above the door, I saw that it was 2 o'clock. We had been sitting there 1.5 hours, and the conversation had been mine alone. I tumbled down into reality, hot-handed and self-conscious, with my face aflame, and began to stammer my apologies. He would not listen to me.
"I told you at the beginning of lunch you had a lovely and unusual name," he said. "I shall go further, if you will forgive me, and say that it becomes you as well as it became your father. I've enjoyed this hour with you more than I have enjoyed anything for a very long time. You've taken me out of myself, out of despondency and introspection, both of which have been my devils for a year."
I looked at him and believed he spoke the truth. He seemed less fettered than he had been before, more modern, more human. He was not hemmed in by shadows.
"You know," he said, "we've got a bond in common, you and I. We are both alone in the world. Oh, I've got a sister, though we don't see much of each other, and an ancient grandmother, whom I pay duty visits to 3 times a year. But neither of them make for companionship. I shall have to congratulate Mrs. Van Hopper. You're cheap, at £90 a year.
You forget, I said. You have a home, and I have none. The moment I spoke, I regretted my words, for the secret, inscrutable look came back in his eyes again, and once again I suffered the intolerable discomfort that floods one after lack of tact. He bent his head to light a cigarette and did not reply immediately.
"An empty house can be as lonely as a full hotel," he said at length. "The trouble is that it is less impersonal."
He hesitated, and for a moment I thought he was going